I'd like to introduce you to Ted H. from Los Angeles.
Get this stuff up here for you.
My name's Ted Harbach, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm alive and sober by a very special grace of a loving God and the loving program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank God that I'm an alcoholic. And if you're a newcomer, that'll make you want to puke. First time I was at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard someone say, "I'm a grateful alcoholic." I left. I came back 2 years later. You told me to keep coming back. I was really at the wrong meeting. I always have been in the wrong place at the wrong time. And sort of the story of my life. Before I get started with my sad tale, I'd like to thank Lynn and Cheryl for asking me to come up here and speak. They're a couple of real magic people. And I'd like to thank Tom for picking me up and being my host. And his lovely wife that's here. You just, as you travel through Alcoholics Anonymous, little Al-Anon that came up with the name of the for the meeting, Courage to Change, you mentioned my favorite word, and that word is magic. And as you travel through Alcoholics Anonymous, every so often you meet a magic person on Alcoholics Anonymous. And you kind of know when you're around one of them, because you just feel better. And you really don't know why, and it doesn't matter why, because knowing why is the booby prize of life.
Why did you do that?
I don't know. It just seemed like a good idea at the time. Normal people, quote, normally always ask us those trick questions. I kind of take that admonition from the large book of Alcoholics Anonymous that says we no longer need be a doormat for anybody. I take that quite literally. And every once in a while, some crap head out there tries to run their racket on me. And it happened not too long ago. I called her. I had developed a little courage to change. So about 4 or 5 years ago, I went back, got my pilot's license again. And the FAA knew who was up there behind that stick. They'd have a fit. And so I called not too long ago to reserve a plane, and I always procrastinate. I got kind of angry at Bob yesterday when he was at the Ascot Basket thing, because he took exception to my definition of serenity and went on to explain how he felt serene when he was taking care of business. I thought, God damn it, they've done it again. All the other people that were in charge of asking speakers, they all asked grown-ups, and mine asked me. Because just this last year, I haven't been able to take care of anything. I mean, the wreckage of my present is just unbelievable. And that's not very good news for a lot of you, I know, coming from almost 19 years of sobriety, if I don't screw this whole thing up and 60 days. Well, April Fool's Day is my birthday. That's a good... That's a good day for me. And so anyway, I called to reserve this plane, and I waited till Friday to reserve it. This woman gets on the phone, and she says, "Well, they're all gone. You should have called on Wednesday." I said, "That's fine. I'd like to do that." She said, "You'd like to do what?" I said, "I'd like to conform to your request. So should have called on Wednesday because I want to get a plane." And she said, "What?" I said, is this Earth? I said, let me talk to the manager. And the manager gets on the phone, and he says, yes, can I help you? And I said, yes. I said, your twit that answered the phone told me that all your planes were gone and for the weekend, and that in order to reserve a plane, I should have called on Wednesday. And he fell right into the trap. He said, well, yes, that's right. You know, I just see him looking down at me, you know. I said, fine, how do I do that? I doubt very seriously whether either one of those people will ever tell anyone that they should have done anything. People, you know, parents do a great job of that on us, you know. Well, if I were you, I would have. Well, I would have if I could have. I know I should have. Now, all those words ought to be amputated from the English language, because all they do is run us on great guilt trips, you know. So no wonder we're so incredibly damaged when we get here. And then yesterday, why, somebody in the middle of my huge dilemma, because my life is totally unmanageable, somebody gives me a question, how do you handle anger? God damn it, with 19 years of sobriety, you don't get angry. And then somebody asks about adult children of alcoholics. I'm going to start a new one. I'm going to call it Achwum. Angry products of hostile wombs. And I gotta promise you that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was the angriest person they had ever seen. They'll tell you that. I didn't know anything about anger, actually. All I did, the only emotion that I knew for years was rage. You know, that's quite a step up from anger. There's one guy on the program, he's been sober about 20 years, and I really liked him. I took to him right on, right at the beginning. Well, he had a very attractive wife, too. And shortly after I was a newcomer, he began avoiding me. And I do not handle that well. And I would do a lot of things, like say hi to him. And he'd turn around and walk away rapidly. And I could never pin him down to find out what was wrong. A few years back, I got asked to speak at a morning meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous Sunday morning out in the valley. And we kind of have a floating poker game that we do every once in a while. I happened to be at these people's house, and they invited us to stay over at their house that night and then go to the meeting on Sunday morning. And I had him. He was sitting right next to me. And I said, you know, Joe, I said, you have avoided me for years around Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I owe you an amend, if I've done something to upset you, I'd like to know about that, because I've been going on about 16 years. And he looked at me and he says, you don't remember? I said, absolutely not. He said, you're kidding. I said, no. Now, this guy is huge. He's about 5'18" or something like that. And he said, I'll tell you why. He said, we were at a meeting at Ohio Street, and you were sober about 6 months. And all of a sudden, he said, it looked like you got upset, and you ran out of the meeting. And he said, I left the meeting and went out to see what was wrong. And I asked you what was wrong, and you said, nothing. And he said, then I put my arm around you, and I asked you again, and he said, you knocked me out cold for 30 minutes. And I have no recollection of that whatsoever. So, but I knew about whiteouts, though, so. You know, then we had this panel over at Long Beach Memorial Hospital for about 8 years, and they started putting stuff into aftercare that was just weird. They had one thing called assertiveness training. Can you believe that? Teaching alcoholics to be assertive? I knew nothing about assertive at all. I went right from being firm to combative. The reason I'm going to start this new club is because that's really what I am. I was angry from the time I was born. And I didn't know a lot about this until just recently. But I was a 10-pound baby, and I was a full breech birth. And my mother weighed just a fraction over 100 pounds. And I understand from my father that the doctor came out of the delivery room, and he said, "There's no way that I can save both your wife and the child. Which one do you want?" And my dad was a very spiritual guy. So when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no problem with a power greater than myself. Because I know from personal experience that God has held me in the palm of his hand since the day I was born. And so, very close to 19 years ago, when the doctor looked down at me and he said, "You know, you're dying. You've actually died from the terminal progressive disease of alcoholism." I looked up at him and all I said was, "Thank you." Because death would have been a far more acceptable alternative than the life that I had been leading for some time. And death does not scare me, because I have faced death 6 times in my life. Starting with that morning when my dad turned to that doctor and he said, "I can't make that choice." So he said, "I'm just going to have to pray that God will have his hand on yours and you'll have to go back in there, and however it turns out, that's the way it's going to be." And the doctor said, "Well, even if I can save them," he said, "there's no way that your wife can ever have another child." And my dad said, "We'll face that when it comes." And 3 years later, my brother was born. And that really confirmed that my life was in trouble. Right after I was born, I was so angry, my grandfather thought it was quite humorous. But I was taken out of the normal room for babies, and I was put in an isolation ward. I was put in solitary confinement. I was put in a room called the obstreperous ward. And what that room is for special children that are totally antisocial. So if you ever hear a little hint of anger coming from me, you will understand perhaps why. I started out that way in life. I was just I'd just been in a rage all my life. And I have been able to handle that to a great extent in Alcoholics Anonymous because of the magic of the program. Because of the magic of the program. When I was 3 years old, my brother came along, and I'd been in charge of the entire universe up to that time. I was born an alcoholic. I mean, the first word my mother said was, "My God, did you see how much he drank?" And that's all I heard from then on. I still hear it. I can get through a six-pack of Coke just as fast as I used to get through a six-pack of Cutty Sark. Because I had all of the attributes that it takes to become a professional drunk. You know, I had a resentment against the entire world and everybody in it, a giant chip on my shoulder, a big mouth, and an insatiable thirst. I just was born thirsty. My dad used to say things like, "Well, you're not an alcoholic. Why can't you be like me? Why can't you just take it or leave it?" I'd say, "I'm half like you. I'll take it." He said, I'd say, "Well, if I'm not an alcoholic, why do you lock up the liquor cabinet?" He says, "Well, if I don't lock it up, strange things happen to it. It all turns to water." Now, the word moderation was never in my vocabulary. I do not understand that part of chapter 3 where it says something about the obsession of the alcoholic is that, or the insanity is that someday, somehow, we will learn to control and enjoy our drinking. I don't think you can enjoy anything you're controlling. I just always lived all my life right out there on the edge, totally out of control, you know. Just had a hell of a time. Except for those unfortunate occasions when I fell off the edge. If you're out there on the end of the string, man, I mean, occasionally it's bound to break. Yeah. And I developed this, I died again when I was about 6 or 7. And my mother was driving me down to Palm Springs to recuperate from having my tonsils out, and I began to cough, and I got car sick. And I always got car sick because I was puny and weak when I was little. I was the original 97-pound weakling. And so I said, I think I'm going to be sick. She pulled over the side of the car over the side of the road, and I leaned out of the door, and I threw up, and it was pure blood. And I'd broken the blood vessel down inside my throat that was too deep for anybody to reach. It was a Sunday morning, and through a curious set of circumstances, my mother drove a 1937 DeSoto at better than 100 miles an hour through downtown Los Angeles. There were no freeways then. And my family doctor was home, and she was able to call him. There were no other doctors available. There were no hospitals available. He met us at the house, and by the time we got there and he realized he couldn't stop the bleeding, he had a hospital bed ready, a surgical theater open, and they went in, and I had lost 7 pints of blood at the age of 7. And I had died one more time. After that, of course, my mother was of the old school that thought that if you're weak, puny, and anemic and all that, why, some fortified port wine will build up your blood. Now, I got started early, folks, with prescribed dosages. And, you know, right from the beginning, it all tasted the same. It all tasted like more. And early on, I developed that alcoholic syndrome where you're holding your glass out to have someone pour it, and just as they start to pour it, you drop the glass. You know what happens? The Al-Anons don't understand that. They still follow the glass with a bottle till it runs over. And then I got into beer early on and all of that stuff. I really didn't turn professional till I was 16. And I remember that very succinctly. I went over to a friend's house, and his mother was giving a little birthday party to celebrate his 16th birthday. And she was serving something that was to become one of my all-time favorites. And that's when I found out that my mother had lied to me, because they served martinis. And she'd always told me martinis were a woman's drink. Now, I don't remember what happened at that little birthday party. I just sat down to have a few quiet martinis with several intimate friends, and when I got up to the from the table, 23 years had gone by. And I never intended for that to happen. I was a blackout drinker. I don't know if you know what a blackout drinker is. That's a guy that finds himself locked outside of his own New Year's Eve party, and he's pounding on the glass door there and yelling and screaming and making faces and trying to get everybody to let him in. Finally, some Al-Anon looks down and she says, "Get out from under the glass top table, you drunk." You see, a curious thing happened to me when I drank alcohol. I found out recently that the reason that I drank was because of the 12 promises on page 83 and 84. A lot of people probably think, that's crazy. How could he drink because of the 12 promises in the magic book of Alcoholics Anonymous? This is not the magic book. This is a tacky reproduction. And you can't afford the real thing, I mean, really. Maybe these are for the Al-Anons. But I found out from Joe and Charlie from Little Rock, Arkansas, that the reason that I drank was because of the 12 promises in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I become very close to Joe McQueenie out of Little Rock. He was the first black member of Alcoholics Anonymous in the entire state of Arkansas 25 years ago. And Joe's done some magic stuff. Some magic stuff. They've gotten a program into the Arkansas State Prison system back there. I don't know how many of you ever saw the movie Brubaker, but it's a true story of the agricultural farm prison farms of the state of Arkansas. It's brutal. Brutal. The recidivism rate, or the return rate of paroled felons from the state penal system in the state of Arkansas, is greater than 60%. And because of the program the magic program that Joe and Charlie have been able to get into that system. They've reduced that return rate for those who have gone through that program, tracked over a seven-year period, from 60% down to 12%. And so when Joe and Charlie told me that I drank because of the 12 promises, I got to believe that. But they read them a little bit differently than we do. And here's how they read them. See, we're told, and I believe firmly and completely, that the reason alcoholics drink is because of the way it makes them feel. That's the way I drank. That's why I drank. Because of the way it made me feel. And here's how I felt. Whenever I drank alcohol, I would know a new freedom and a new happiness. Whenever I drank alcohol, I would not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. Whenever I drank alcohol, I would comprehend the word peace and I would know serenity. Whenever I drank alcohol, no matter how far down the scale I had gone, I could see how my experience could benefit others. Whenever I drank alcohol, that feeling of uselessness and self-pity would disappear. Whenever I drank alcohol, I would lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in my fellows, especially the broads. Whenever I drank alcohol, self-seeking would slip away. Whenever I drank alcohol, my whole attitude and outlook on life would change. Whenever I drank alcohol, fear of people and economic insecurity would leave me. Whenever I drank alcohol, I would intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle me. Whenever I drank alcohol, I would suddenly realize that alcohol was doing for me what I could not do for myself. And then isn't it amazing that because of a magic deal called Alcoholics Anonymous, that I can live within those 12 promises active in my life today, that were the very reason that I drank alcohol, that were the very reason why I drank. And I can experience those same feelings and those same truths in my life today without any mind-altering chemicals or any alcohol of any kind, as a result of a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. See, when I drank alcohol, why, I was able to move from reality into a land that Dennis Waitley calls the land of Someday Isle. And that's where alcoholics spend most of their time, in that land of Someday Isle. Someday I'll get it together. Someday I'll get that good job. Someday I'll have a relationship. Someday I'll take a trip. In that land of chameleon-like people-pleasing, where we end up living our lives for someone else's expectations, real or imagined, where I would do the things that I thought you wanted me to do so that I would be acceptable, where I would say the things that I thought you wanted to hear so you'd like me, and where I would be the person I thought you wanted me to be so that I could be a part of, so that maybe through this chemical magic I could, for the first time in my life, be as good as, measure up to, be a part of. Maybe for the first time in my life, a magic would happen in here where my insides would match your outsides, and I suddenly had the answer. And I could live in that land of rationalizing, of paranoid lying and self-delusion that is the hallmark of the alcoholic. The insanity of alcoholism is living with those rationalizations, believing that they are the truth. And then at one moment, suddenly, hopefully, the alcoholic says, God, I'm an alcoholic, and my life is unmanageable. And he moves back to the center line between sanity and insanity, between rationalization and truth. But he can't stay there. He can't stay there. There's only one thing that can move him back to the other side permanently, and that's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what this whole deal is all about. I spent 23 years over on that other side of the line. A lot of people call it crossing over the invisible line. It wasn't invisible to me, man. I knew right where it was. I knew just what it took to get over the line, and I knew how much it took to stay over there. And I stayed over there just as long as I could. Just as long as I could. And in that area over there on the other side of the line, I was able to do those things that was absolutely impossible for me to do before I found the magic of alcohol. Because, see, in here was a terrified little human being that I would have risked my life to keep you from finding, and I damn near made it. I damn near made it. But when I found that magic over there, it was the land of Someday Isle. And I can make a lot of that stuff come true. See, behind alcohol at the age of 16, I had a race car on the track behind a Ford's birth certificate. At the age of 18, I was a charter member of the Mount Baldy Ski Patrol, one of the most dangerous mountains in the entire world. Used to kill six people as regular as clockwork. Social drinkers, usually. You know, they'd have half a glass of wine and then fly off the backside of the mountain and get a free 1,000-foot fall there into Victorville. And about all you ever heard them say was, oops. I helped do the first article for Life magazine on scuba diving in 1948, and I don't know if any of you ever been under the water in the ocean, but it's terrifying. I mean, they got animals under there just scary inside out, but we found out, I found out early on, see, the difference between a hero and a coward. It's booze. And we found out that if you put a dish of pure grain alcohol right in front of the intake manifold of the compressor, you can just bubble that air right through there and fill that tank with about 50% alcohol vapor. I gotta promise you, with a rig like that, you can stand right on the deck of the ship and get euphoria of the deep. You are not afraid. Buying alcohol, I learned how to fly airplanes, and I learned how to run businesses. At the age of 24, I was one of the youngest subdividers in California, and I was on my way to becoming a millionaire. At the age of 24, I was building over 200 houses a year. And I could have been anyone, and I could have gone anywhere, and I could have done anything. I just couldn't find out from you people who I was supposed to be, and where I was supposed to go, and what I was supposed to do. And already, at the age of 24, I was in the grip of a terminal progressive disease called alcoholism. And already, I was getting information that I was bodily and mentally different than my fellows. I remember my partner used to say, how can you drink those damn martinis at lunch? If I had half a martini, I'd just fall asleep. Well, you know what I said to him? A feller like you just shouldn't drink. See, that booze was the fuel that fired the boilers in me. And it made life acceptable. And so when I came to that first A&A meeting and some of the fools said, well, in A&A we just don't drink. Isn't that spiffy? I had not drank for two whole weeks in 23 years and life was unacceptable. And if that's all you did in A&A, why pass? You were all old anyway. Well, my God, some of you were 40. I remember you're all lined up around the walls of that first meeting with your heads in your hands and your life was over. And the old French Foreign Legion Hall in Beverly Hills or something. And nobody paid the light bill and the gas had been turned off. And there's some skinny little outfit standing up in back of the microphone. I didn't know she was standing there for a long time. She was standing sideways. And finally she turned around and I thought, my heavens, that'd be like making love to a gunny sack full of antlers. And finally she said something like, if you want what we have. Are you kidding, honey? If you got anything, hang on to it. I couldn't believe it. And I left again. And I came back 2 years later. You're still the same. Still the same.
Well, you just don't drink. That's what you do.
All right, I couldn't believe it. See, I found out early on that alcoholics have a selective hearing. We hear just what we want to hear when we want to hear it. That's what we hear. So if you're working with some craphead newcomer, why... what you say is, you did not hear what I said. I like what Sandy Beach used to say. He used to say, his sponsor's telling me, he says, what that means is that Sandy's going to die if you don't do it this way. Yeah. We have selective hearing and we have selective seeing also. We see just what we want to see. And I drank for 23 years. I didn't have a whole lot of trouble with alcohol. People around me had a lot of trouble with my alcohol. But I had no problem with alcohol. My only problem was a matter of logistics, making sure that I had plenty of it around at all times. And I remember one time I finally had moved into a skid row of my very own design. It was the unfinished concrete basement of an old beat-up house hanging on the side of a cliff in Silver Lake. I had to live in the basement. I couldn't afford by that time to live in the house. It was rented. And one night I developed this incredible combination that I was using because I was bleeding to death by this time. And I still had about another 6 months to drink. And it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and it was raining, and it was a terrible storm, about like your average weather up here. And I was out of booze, and I was frantic. And so I got a hold of the phone book, because my phone was still connected. Well, actually, my phone wasn't still connected. I had it stabbed into my tenant's line. And I called his pharmacy, and I said, I need some prescriptions filled. And he said, well, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, I didn't call for a goddamn time check. I said, I'm going to give you two choices. Either I'll go down and open up the pharmacy, or you can. You talk about willpower. If willpower could keep an alcoholic from drinking, we'd have no problem. So he met me down there with the police, and policeman said, I understand you threatened this man, told him you're going to break up in his pharmacy. I said, nothing of the kind. I said, I'll give you the same choice, officer. I said, I'll tell you what. I said, you can let this pharmacist fill my little order here, and I'll go home and bleed to death all over the floor of my basement, or you can take me down to your goddamn jail, and I'll bleed to death all over the floor of your new jail. Which do you prefer? Because I said, you see, I don't really care. Now, there's one thing that normal people have a great deal of difficulty handling. They can't handle the truth. And see, and he knew he was looking down both barrels of the unmitigated truth. He turned to this little pharmacy, he says, well, why don't you... patted this little Oriental guy on the head, and, you know... Half an hour later, I walked out with one quart of Cutty Sark, a pint of Belladonna, a bottle of about 200 pills of Librium. This was before doctors had found out that alcoholism was caused by a Valium deficiency. And 4 pints of Maalox and some cream and a bag of ice. I went home to mix my famous concoction. See, now the Belladonna, you got to pour about... Use it in an old-fashioned glass. I mean, you know... Not an old-fashioned mint julep glass. You know, those great, big, huge mothers. You get a lot of stuff in. Crack up the ice and shave it, because that kind of freezes the esophagus and the stomach lining so that the primary reaction isn't so great from the initial insult of what's coming. And you pour 2 hookers of Belladonna in there, and that kind of anesthetizes all of this and gets it ready. Okay? And you grind up about 8 Librium pills in there. Now, the reason for that is, in case this whole mess doesn't work, you don't care. And then you pound up about 4 Maalox pills in there, because that's what the paramedics give you. And then you put a bunch of cream in there, because that's what the bartender gives you, because he knows about ulcers and drinking. mean, who else can you get all this vital information from, see? Then you pour a half a fifth of scotch in there and get it on. And that's how I was living the last 6 months. And finally, I came out of my last alcoholic blackout, and I was in the intensive care unit at St. John's Hospital. And I remember going to the doctor's office. I had to have a... I tried to drive to the doctor that morning, and I couldn't make it because I was running out of gas. I knew I was bleeding to death inside. And so I had to stop, and I got an Al-Anon to drive me the rest of the way. It's sick. I mean, those Al-Anons are so sick. I hope there's a lot of them at the meeting tonight. Today. You need the meetings. I'm coming back in my next reincarnation as an Al-Anon, though. It's the ideal program. You can work the steps and drink. I mean, you'd have to if you're married to one of us. And so she drove me to this doctor's office, and I'd called him, and he had one of these prissy, prim little nurses that likes to put you on hold.
The doctor will be with you in a moment.
I said, lady, I'm bleeding to death, and I would like to see the doctor now. And she said, oh, yes, it'll be all right. I said, no, it's not. You're just not getting the message. See, now, I'd done this when I was 6 years old, so I knew how. She said, it'll be just a minute. And I said, no, I think it'll be right now. And I threw up all over her goddamn appointment book. Blood red, man, did I get her attention. And I said, now are we going to see the doctor or you want another shot? Hey, and that's the way I live my life. See, I just walked all over everybody and I didn't give a damn about any place, person, or thing. Nothing that I care about. See? And they got me in the hospital and I came out of that blackout because I went into a coma and my doctor was looking down at me and he was crying. And I said, why are you crying? And he says, well, because you died and your life's over. And I said, why is it over? He says, well, because you got it all. I've been telling you for 10 years. I said, well, what's all? I was getting interested. I realized by now he was kind of talking about me, maybe. He said, well, you got alcoholic gastritis. That's not too big a deal. You throw up a little bright red blood now and then. But use that magic formula and, you know, great huge glass. And he said, and you got cirrhosis of the liver. You have hemorrhagic pancreatitis. You know, I've bent and broken almost every bone in my body, and I've experienced a lot of pain, but I have never experienced any pain as exotic as pancreatitis. That hurt so much, I'd have to get out of bed to turn over. And I knew I couldn't drink for 1 week. And my God, the terror of knowing that. And he said, besides that, you got two ulcers that are hemorrhaging, you're bleeding from every opening in your body, and your blood pressure is 60 over 40. Now, for those of you that don't know what 60 over 40 is, that's serene. That is terminal serenity. And he said, we pushed 7 pints of your blood type, and the bank is empty, and that's why you're dying. And besides, I said, oh, God, is there more? You're usually getting me involved in the plot. He said, yes, if you don't promise me you'll never drink again as long as you live, I won't even treat you. I promise. I said, just get me out of this tacky hospital. I said, you got me in this bed that some puke is wet. I was a fireproof drunk. I never had to worry about getting water to put the fire out. I always had this little yellow fire break around me. Great fringe benefits of the program was when my wife finally threw away the rubber sheet 7 years after I was sober. It takes a long time to build back that trust, you know. Ten days later, I was back out on the street and I was drunk again. He told me I hadn't ought to do that anymore. And I came off that last drunk and I was sitting on the side of that bed. In that skid row of my own design, that old basement of that house in Silver Lake. And everything was broken. And I believe that's the best way to describe the condition of an alcoholic such as myself at that moment. Broken. Everything was broken. Broken dreams, broken promises, broken hearts, broken families, broken marriages, broken promises, yeah. Broken houses, broken businesses, broken bank accounts, broken laws, broken cars. A broken mind, a broken body, and a broken soul, and it was all over, and I had hit bottom in all six categories. Physically, mentally, morally, socially, financially, and spiritually. And it was all over. And in my hour of direst need, I cried out to the God of my childhood, and he heard me. Because as I said, I'd known from the time I was born that he held me in the palm of his hand. And he answered me. And the only word I recall was the word remember. And I remembered. I remembered another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I'd been to, and I can't tell you when it was or where. But I remember an old-timer had come up to me, and he'd said something like this. He said, Ted, in this place called Alcoholics Anonymous, there is so much more than just not drinking. That's just the beginning. But he said, I don't believe that you're serious about this deal. I think you're just chipping around with a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I believe you're going to have to go out and do some more research and drink some more until you reach a bottom. It's necessary for each person to satisfy the admonition laid down in Chapter 3, which says we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost self that we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. And until you reach that bottom, which is necessary for every human being that's an alcoholic, to surrender. And it's a different bottom for each one. He said, until you reach that point, I think you're going to have to stay out there. But one day, he said, when you reach that bottom, he said, I pray to God you'll remember that there's a magic place where you can come. Where he said, I absolutely guarantee you, you can find a way to live your life comfortably with unsolved problems without ever having to drink again as long as you live. And where you will meet people, I promise you, that will end up meaning more to you than the members of your very own family. Because when you need these people, they'll be there. And they'll be there just for you. And they'll be there for only one reason. Because they care. And they call it Alcoholics Anonymous. And in this magic place, I promise you, he said, that you can find a God of your very own that you can take with you wherever you go. So you need never be alone again as long as you live. In a magic place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I came back to a little park on Roxbury in Beverly Hills where I grew up and used to play as a kid. And that's where I found those old-timers with 20 and 30 years that walked the walk of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it seemed to me they wore their sobriety like a crown. And they were doing the one thing that I'd wanted to do all my life in the face of all adversity, in the face of terminal illnesses, losing loved ones, losing businesses, all adversity. They were just stepping out easy. But they were doing it without taking any mind-altering chemicals or drinking any alcohol of any kind, and somehow in the madness of insanity that was to be mine for a long, long time. And I wanted what they had. And I came back. That night when I left that meeting, it was April Fool's Day of 1968. And as I left that meeting, my God looked down on me, and he removed the obsession to drink alcohol from me forever, never to be returned. And I believe I know a little bit in part today why that happened. It happens to about half of us. And if that obsession has not been removed yet, I pray to God that you can hurry on with the program so that you can reach the point where it will be promised to be removed and that you reach that point before the test comes. Because you see, there's a test in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous.
The test says this. There will come a time in the life of every alcoholic where there will be no mental defense against taking the first drink. And when that test comes, if you are not prepared, you will drink because it's promised. That is the definition of the classic slip. Not the programmed drunk. You can tell when you're programming a drunk. I kind of went over this in the meeting yesterday, but there are a lot of you that weren't here. I can tell you, or pardon me, you can tell exactly when you're programming a drunk. When you find yourself criticizing any human being or any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you are setting yourself up with an excuse to stop coming back, to stop working on the program in your life of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you will have set up your drunk. So don't come to me and tell me.
You had a little slippy poo.
You just made a conscious decision with that criticism that you'd rather be drunk than sober. As simple as that. I'll welcome you back. See, I'll go to hell and back with you if you want to try and quit drinking. But if you don't want to try and quit drinking, you can go to hell all by yourself. Because that's the way it is. That's the way it is. I finally found out from those old-timers how this program works. And I hear a lot of stuff from these podiums today, and it bothers me because it frightens me. And maybe we're going to lose the program. Because I hear a lot of stuff that just doesn't ring true. Now, what those old-timers told me was that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is the only way that an alcoholic can obtain and maintain their sobriety. And those old-timers went on to define sobriety for me. You see, they told me that sobriety only begins with stopping drinking, that is simply physical sobriety. And there are many, many people that stay in physical sobriety until that pain becomes so great they must drink. See, we don't really have to make too many choices in life. The choices are made for us to a great extent by pain. When the pain of continuing on becomes greater than the pain of changing, we change. And that's it. It takes the courage, a courageous person, to face that pain. But remember, pain is good. Pain is good. Because if there wasn't any pain, then it just didn't matter. See, a little over a year ago, I found it necessary to separate from my wife and my little daughter, who's been sober 15 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's no big deal because she's only 15. But there's a lot of pain there. But you see, if there was no pain, my daughter wouldn't matter to me. And if there was no physical pain, I would get no message that I was doing something wrong with my body. And it wouldn't matter. So pain is good. And pain teaches us to have the courage to look at it for what it is, accept it for what it is, and then change so that we can let our God know we got the message. I remember one time I was working on a ski patrol, and I turned to this guy and I said, you better help. Let me help you into the ski patrol and do something about that leg of yours. He said, well, it's just sprained. I'm walking it out. I said, well, while you're walking around, I said, don't get that bone that's sticking out of the other side caught on any shrubbery. He just really hadn't gotten the message. Program. to obtain and maintain. And then they told me that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is in the magic book, between pages 1 and 164, and that's all there is to it. There isn't any more. And all the rest of the books and all the rest of the pamphlets and all of that stuff, that's just fringe benefits, made for discussion meetings mainly. You know, where people would rather discuss it than do it. And the roundups and the meetings before the meetings after the meetings, the roundups and the conventions. Well, all of that, see, is the fellowship. And I thank God for the unconditional love of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that supported me and carried me until I could find my way through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The old-timers told me that the program is divided into three parts, the 12 steps. The first three steps are becoming willing to turn your will and your life over to the care of God, they told me. The next six steps are how you actually turn it over to God. And the last three steps are how you keep it turned over for the rest of your life. And that's all there is to it. And it's as simple as that. And it's so gentle, and it's so easy. But you know, we like to make things complicated. And I mentioned yesterday that I was listening not too long ago to an academic physicist who was talking on TV. And he was talking about the basic building blocks of life and the universe and the human body. And how they thought that molecules were the smallest part, and then atoms, and then down to the quarks, and then how all of the different ones spread out, and the moderator was going crazy. And he says, well, how do you keep track of all of that? And this great wise man from England said, well, you don't have to keep track of it because that's what happens. He said, what we're really looking for is the basic beginning of the whole thing. And he said, actually, it's far more simple than it has any right to be. And I thought immediately of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is far more simple than it has any right to be. Anything that can have the dramatic, dynamic effect on human beings and their lives and their relationships to others and to their God of their own choosing has got to be more simple than it has any right to be. And yet we want to complicate it. We just want to complicate it so badly. And so I had to begin. And then they told me how. If the first three steps are becoming willing to turn your will and your life over to the care of God, then that's all it is. You just simply do that. I hear people all the time say, well, I'm praying for the willingness. Well, you know, if you've ever seen a hold-up artist stuff a .45 automatic in some guy's ear and say, turn it over. You know, I don't understand really praying for willingness and all that stuff. If you go in to get a job and they say, well, the first step is to fill out this employment application. And you say, well, I'm sorry, I've got to go to an employment application meeting. I'll have to get an employment application sponsor. And, you know, you just take the step, that's all. You just fill it out. And that's really all there is. I don't know anything about working a program or working steps. I just know about taking them. You just take the step. I don't even know how you do the first two steps because there's no instructions in my magic book of Alcoholics Anonymous. All it says is after that part of Chapter 5 you heard read today and at every meeting practically, that our description of the alcoholic, the chapter of the agnostic, and our stories before and after made clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. That should be patently obvious to the most insane. Okay? And that no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Well, we've tried everything. I mean, we've got poor psychiatrists with the highest suicide rate known to mankind. Because they still dare to treat alcoholics, you know. Mine, I just made him totally crazy. You know, he'd say, well, why are you nervous? I developed this little tick where, you know, in the middle of signing my signature, my pen would fly across the room. I knew that I had to go and have a drink right now or I'd fly across the room. I said, well, I'm nervous. He said, why are you nervous? I said, let me tell you something, Doc. At $65 an hour, you're going to figure that out. He said, well, do you drink? I said, sure, I'll have a scotch and water. He said, no, that's not what I mean. He said, how much do you drink? I said, well, I'm not sure. How much do you have? And this little vein in his forehead started jumping in and out. Everybody's veins started jumping in and out after I talked to them for 5 minutes. He said, well, no, that's not what I mean. He said, have you drank all your life? And I said, no, not yet. And then he said, well, do you dream? I said, oh, yeah, do I dream? I had no problem with step two when I got here. And you sit in those bars until 2 a.m. thinking up dreams to talk to him about the next day at $65 an hour, you know. And finally, after a protracted length of time, why, they begin to get a little honest, and they say something like, well, I don't think I can help you anymore. What he means is he can't stand to have you around anymore. He says, I think you better go to A&A. And then he hands you a little bill, and you look at it, and you go, oh, $85,000, no big thing. You write him a little, cut him a little reader there, and he goes to the bank, and the banker tells him your account's closed, and he jumps out the window. So no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and, you know, we've tried everything. But maybe God could and would if he were sought. Not found, just sought. Next sentence says, being convinced of this, we were at step three. That's it. I hear people all the time say, well, I take step one and two every day. Well, what are they doing? What are they doing? I've got to stand up there and I've got to, well, today I admit that I'm Ted Harbach and I'm an alcoholic. You know. They're about 80 million miles from acceptance, if that's the trick case. You know, I don't know how you do that. Being convinced of this or accepting. If you're not convinced, go out and get drunk. Some more, a lot. Get beat up by whatever it is you do out there to be hip, slick, and cool. Until you're convinced of those three ideas, and then if you can, come back. If there's anything left of you, miraculously, you're at step three. And there's one other way you can do that, a softer, easier way. This magic book, I hate this book. The big book, the large one. Thanks. The first four chapters, plus the doctor's opinion at the beginning, are designed specifically and exactly for a couple of purposes. Number one is to explain the exact nature of our disease. Number two is to plant us firmly on a path towards a power greater than ourselves and guarantee us that we will reach it. It's promised. Okay? And thirdly, to convince us of those three ideas. And that's why in the first chapter it says, right at the beginning, this has become the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what it says on page one. So if you want to learn how to do anything, you got to read the damn book. And when I wanted to get my pilot's license again, I had to go read the damn book. It's blue, but it's a different book. And it explains the exact nature of what I'm going to try and do and all the trick phrases and the words and all of that stuff. And it gives me the program of how I'm going to do that. And that's what that's about. Being convinced of that, we're at step three. Now, still, if you have enough strength left after all of that effort to turn the page over, why, there's a prayer for step three. And now, that's a big deal. I hear people all the time saying, well, I do step three every day. Well, that's okay, I guess. They're beginning to get ready to start to commence, and they haven't done anything yet. It's like standing on the side of the street saying, well, I have made a decision to cross the street. 4 years later, somebody walks by and says, hi, how are you doing, George? Fine. Fine, everything's fine. Why haven't you crossed the street, George? Well, I don't know. I make a decision every morning to do that. What book are they reading? You know. That's like sitting on the side of your bed saying, well, I don't know why I'm starving to death. I'm willing to eat. You know. Besides that, if you turn the page over, one more page, right at the top of page 64, right after that prayer for step three, where you made this monumental decision, it says, though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect. Well, that's hardly anything. Little permanent. That's almost zero. Unless followed at once by a strenuous effort to face and achieve by a searching and fearless moral inventory. At once. Now, that's rather soon. Now, I hear these people say, well, I don't think you better do your inventory for about another 2 years. It might hurt your feelings. Then I see these inventories, my God, and they're these vast autobiographies, you know. Start out from the insemination of the egg by the sperm. And, you know, done with word processors with spelling programs in them. You know, what book are they reading? All my book says, made a list of everyone you're pissed off at. Use a long word, resentment, you know. And then find somebody to share that stuff with. And there's a list you make of the resentments, and then one of the fears, and then your sex deviations, and the reasons for them. That,
angry at my mother because she put me on the potty backwards.
Which affected my social security and my spiritual security and my financial security and my physical security. She did it because she wanted to watch. Never seen a little boy do that before. And then you do something and say,
oh, that's wonderful.
And a few months later, you bring her a big pile of it, and it's bad. And you begin to get these dual messages in life that just ruin us. You know, and your father comes along and gives you this great passage that's guaranteed to make a success out of you. Son, now, look before you leap. And he who hesitates is lost. Trying to do those two things together, you're really screwed. And find somebody to share this mess with, you know, and hopefully they've read the book. Because if they haven't, they're liable to say something like, oh, that's wonderful, now burn it. And that's unfortunate, because a few pages later it says, referring to our list, which you've now burned, you know, God, it's just weird. Now, after you've shared that inventory with somebody, hopefully, that's able to look at the patterns that are reoccurring in your life and help you kind of sort that out. Why, come home and turn to what I believe is the most magic page in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you don't remember anything that I said this morning, why, I pray to God you'll remember page 75. There's 10 promises on page 75, and I don't hear many people talk about that page much. That's not the 12 promises on 83 and 84. There's 10 promises on page 75. And it's sandwiched right in there just like what it's supposed to be, a gift from God. And there's only two things you can do with it. You can throw it away and never know, or you can take it and make it part of yourself and be eternally grateful for the most magic gift that God ever gave to mankind. You know, when Bill Wilson wrote this magic book of Alcoholics Anonymous, his secret dream was that one day, maybe, it would be adopted as a philosophy for the entire world. My God, what a world it would be if everyone was living in unconditional love, looking at their own character defects and trying to change them, making amends for their transgressions immediately or as soon as possible, living with that kind of a deal. It'd really be boring. Al-Anons would all be killing themselves. Nobody to save. On page 75 it says that... See, that's the beginning of the whole deal right there. On page 75 it says, we're preparing an arch through which we'll walk a free person. I'm free today, by the definition in the big book, which says... Freedom is doing what I have to do because I want to do it. It says all fears will fall away. Can you believe that? You won't know that till later on you screw up the courage to take the risk, to do the one thing that's absolutely terrified you, and find out that that fear has been removed. It says, if the obsession to drink alcohol has not been removed prior to this point, it will most certainly be removed now. It goes on to say on that page, we will sense the nearness of God and we will feel as if we are on the broad highway with our Creator. You will have brushed the face of God. You will have established a conscious contact with a power greater than yourself. All right there on page 75 and six more promises. My God, what a gift. For God's sake, hurry on, lest the test come before you're ready. See, the test says that there'll be no mental defense. But also, my book says that at that moment, I have a daily reprieve from the terminal progressive disease of alcoholism, and that at that moment, my sobriety will be contingent upon my spiritual condition. And then it goes on to explain that my spiritual condition is contingent upon two things. It says, if I just try to practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in my daily affairs, just try, and if I just try to keep my spiritual house in order, I need never fear drinking again as long as I live. You may add one day at a time if you wish. But there's two hooks in that statement. You have to know what the principles are and have put them into practice in order to keep on practicing them. And you have got to have gotten your spiritual house in some sort of order in order to keep it in order. And that is what steps 4 through 9 are all about. Hurry on with the program. Now, having made your list, why, then it comes to the amends. And remember that step 9 says, made direct amends wherever possible. It does not say whenever. Whenever is a place, is a time, I mean, and wherever is a place. It's gentle. It's easy. If someone's died that you'd like to make amends to, why, write them a letter in the first person, just like they were there. All those emotions you always wanted to share and somehow never could. All those things you always wanted to say and somehow never had time in the first person, just like they were there. And when you're finished, go some quiet place and read that letter out loud. In the first person, just like they were there. Because maybe they are. When you're finished, you can burn that one. And you can continue to do that the rest of your life. And you'll complete something, and a magic will happen like everything that you'll never know about unless you try it. Now it all doesn't matter anyway, because you're trapped in step 10 for the rest of your life. And the last three steps are how you keep it turned over for the rest of your life. And step 10 is 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, all wrapped up into one step. And I just had a desperate problem about 6 weeks ago, and I came home and I was so despondent and so despairing, and I did not know, I thought, where to turn. But see, I always know where to turn today. And I had to get down on my knees and I had to start writing. And I wrote on and on because I just couldn't keep doing what I was doing. See, I lost a six-figure job that just disappeared a year ago, March, and I had to leave my little wife and my daughter, and I've gone through a lot of stuff in the last year. And I finally decided I just can't sell something that I don't believe in to people that can't afford it, for companies I don't like. I can't do that. And I was out of my profession that I've been in for 18 years since I've been sober, and I had to write about it. And then I had to call a friend of mine, and a fabric began to form, and I had to call a friend of mine and share that. And I had to get his feedback, because I don't trust myself completely, see? And the great message is I don't have to. I don't ever have to trust myself completely, and I don't ever have to be alone again as long as I live. I got down on my knees, and I began to pray, and I asked God for help with this deal. And in the morning, the fabric was together. And a new plan was there for my life today. And 6 weeks ago, I started my life over again, one more time. Out on the edge. See, riding the big horse on the carousel. Because that's the only place you get a chance to grab the brass ring. That's where I put my daughter when she was little, and rode the merry-go-round for the first time. She said, why do I have to ride the big horse on the outside? It goes so fast. I said, because you're going to be a participant in life. And that's where the brass ring is. That's where you get the chance to reach out and stretch and try and grab it. And I've grabbed it a lot of times in my life. Sometimes it slipped away, and sometimes I've thrown it away. Sometimes I lost it, and sometimes I just misplaced it. I get to do that one more time. See, there's only three kinds of people in life. They're the observers, and they sit on the inside of the carousel and watch it all go around. Life is what's happening while they're waiting for it to start. And they're home today, watching television one more time, watching other people get the goodies and do the things they'd like to do. And they're the observers in life. And then there's the critics, and they're out in the bars tonight, telling everybody how it ought to be if they were running it. And they just criticize everybody, and they just find fault. They don't do anything about it, because they're just critics. And then we have God's real gift, which is you people, the participants in life. They're out there on the outside ring, the ones that are driving these roundups and conventions, the ones that are carrying the message and doing the 12-step work, the ones that are out there with the hospital and institution committees, the ones that are carrying the message to the alcoholic that still suffers, and you're participating in life. The ones that are looking inward to their character defects and trying to do something about them. And just take the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just take them one at a time. Running your own businesses and doing it. Doing it. Finding somebody to help out there with a product or with a service or with a gift from God of sobriety, whatever it is. And the fabric came together one more time. And that is how you turn it over. By writing about it and making a little package, and then by sharing with somebody so it's not so heavy, and then I can take it to my God so easily in step 7 and ask Him to help me with it. And that's how I turn it over. And every time I do that, if whatever's bothering me comes back, it doesn't come back as often, it doesn't last as long, it doesn't have the power it had before. But if it does come back, I just get to do that over and over until finally it's just relegated to the scrap heap of serenity. Never to bother me again, separated by the little word and. When we were wrong, promptly admitted it, steps 8 and 9. And I don't find I need that step much anymore because, see, for me, love is never having to say you're sorry. And what that means to me is that I love every one of you from the bottom of my heart to such an extent that I would never intentionally do or say the slightest thing that would harm any one of you in the least way. But not being perfect, if I should step on your foot in error, I have step 8 and 9 and the last half of step 10 to take care of it immediately. And so in step 10, I have the God-given tools that I dare not leave my home with any morning lest I need them during the day that are absolutely guaranteed to free me completely from any guilt, shame, resentment, or fear in the exact time as the distance from the pencil to the paper and a loving heart of Alcoholics Anonymous, because my God is with me all of the time. And there is a magic, I promise you, between the pencil and the paper that will never, ever happen between the mind and the mouth. And I don't know why that is, and I don't care. But I do know this. I do know that writing is the culmination of mankind's dreams. And that if someone had not picked up a pencil and a piece of paper, nothing in this world would have ever happened. There would be no gorgeous architecture. There would be no beautiful paintings. There would be no music. There would be no Holy Bible. There would certainly be no magic book of Alcoholics Anonymous unless someone had picked up a pencil and a piece of paper. And who am I to argue with that? My God, what power. Use it. In step 11, one of the promises comes true. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve the conscious contact that you made somewhere back there between step 5 and 6 when you brushed the face of God. Praying only for His will for us and the power to carry that out. So gentle. So easy. In step 12, another promise comes true. Having had a spiritual awakening, which is defined in the back of the book as a personality change, sufficient to recover from the disease of alcoholism, we tried to carry this message, the message of how our personality changed, what we had to do to change our personality. and recover from the disease of alcoholism. Carry that message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And practice these principles, the principles of honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, because that's how it works, H-O-W, in our daily affairs. And humility, and I like the definition of humility in my big book, no longer find it necessary to confuse humility with humiliation. We did that long enough. Humility, it's Aristotle, a great Greek philosopher's definition in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Very simply, the willingness to become teachable. And when I became willing to allow you to teach me, I found a way of living my life that I never dreamed possible, and I found a magic that I never knew existed in the hearts of the loving people of Alcoholics Anonymous, in a magic program dedicated to recovery, in a way of living that I never knew even existed. And so if you're new or if you're old or wherever you are tonight, I have three prayers for you. See, I pray to God that if you are new, you can just keep coming back and listening to the music until you can understand the words. Listening to the music of alcoholics, maybe for the first time in their life, it'll laugh at themselves. The healing magic of the laughter and the love of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've seen put back together broken and shattered human beings that no human power could have ever put back together. And the loving programs of Al-Anon and Al-Ateen. Say that I've seen put back together broken and shattered families and broken and shattered children. No human power could have ever put back together. And I pray to God that you can just put your hand in ours and come with us. Because we've been there and we know the way. And it'll be okay. But hang on real tight and don't let go. Because if you let go, we're going to lose you. And we don't want to lose anybody. Not if we can help. And the third prayer for you today, the really tough one, the really hard one. Let us, pray God, love you until you can learn to love yourself. And so if you keep coming back and listening to the music and hanging on to these people and letting them love you, maybe one day I'll get extra lucky and I'll be sitting out in the audience, and maybe one of you newcomers will be up here, or one of your old timers. Maybe you'll be getting a birthday. A celebration of sobriety. Maybe if I get real lucky, why, I'll see a tear in your eye. And I'll hear a catch in your voice. And then I'll know that you know. Because you either know in this life or you don't know. And there isn't anything in between. See, I'll know that somewhere along the way you fell in love with a deal called Alcoholics Anonymous. Somewhere along the way you brushed the face of God. Somewhere along the way, you found your way, and the heavens became gentle somewhere along the way. For God's sake, stay with us and find the way. Live every day as if it were your last, and love every moment of every day, because there just isn't time to do anything else. Thank you, and I love you all.